Hello, survivalists. Welcome to the Crux 2 Survival Story Podcast. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh, and today we're diving back into our gripping tales that have captured the hearts and minds of our listeners. As we recount the most riveting stories from the Crux archives, I'll be your guide. Join me on this journey as we uncover the resilience of the human spirit and explore the lessons learned from those who face the ultimate test of survival. Let's embark on this adventure together, where every story is a testament to the indomitable will to survive. First, we bring you a heart-pounding tale of one hiker's fight for survival on a sunny but treacherous Christmas Eve morning in 2022 in the San Gabriel Mountains.
In our featured story, we delve into the harrowing experience of Ruth Woroniki, a 40-year-old adventurer who embarked on a seemingly idyllic hike to Cucamonga Peak, one of Los Angeles's most sought-after mountaintops, towering over 8,000 feet. Little did she know that her descent from the summit would be a life-changing ordeal. Picture this. The sun was shining brightly, casting a warm glow over snow-covered landscape. As Ruth made her way down the mountain, a sense of tranquility enveloped her. But her serenity was short-lived. As she approached an exceptionally icy segment of the trail, her heart quickened with the realization that she was ill-equipped to traverse the perilous terrain with necessary traction. The next thing she knew was that she was awakening after a 200-foot fall with some significant injuries. Ruth Woroniki is a server in Las Vegas. Her family arrived in California right after Thanksgiving. They were actually there on a service trip. She was there with her parents and her siblings. They were doing outreach on Skid Row and visiting prisoners. She had been a very active person, very athletically inclined. On the morning of her hike, she had decided between this hike and a 20-mile run. Obviously, she's pretty used to exercising a lot.
Yeah, I think she made the right choice. If I'm ever trying to choose something between that and a 20-mile run, I will always choose the other thing. just like she did.
Do you regularly grapple with that question? 20-mile run or XYZ something else? Is that a question you ask yourself often?
20-mile run or eat glass? I'll take the eating glass. 20-mile run or tetanus shots to the eyeballs. I'll take the tetanus shots.
All right. I'm so glad to know that.
Yeah. I think I've mentioned before, not a runner. Never have, never will be.
Okay. Now we know where you stand. As I mentioned before, she decided to go up Cucamonga Peak. She grew up in Colorado. She had a lot of hiking experiences. The elevation of Cucamonga Peak stands at an impressive elevation of over 8,800 feet or 2,682 meters above sea level. It's one of the highest peaks in the San Gabriel Mountains and offers hikers stunning panoramic views of the surrounding landscape. The San Gabriel Mountain Range, which is situated in the eastern part of LA or Los Angeles County, is located in the Cucamonga Wilderness with the San Gabriel Mountain National Monument. It's a pretty popular destination for hikers and outdoor enthusiasts, and it can actually be accessed via different trailheads. This hike is 11.6 miles, and it's considered strenuous with 4,300 feet of vertical elevation gain, and it takes an average of 7.36 hours to complete. Cucamonga Peak can be hiked year-round, but conditions vary with the seasons. During the winter, it's not uncommon for the trail to be covered with snow and ice, which can make it challenging and potentially dangerous. Ruth's family was staying at Lyle Creek Campground, and the trailhead was about 1.2 hours from the campground by car. She brought with her supplies that included her hiking poles, water, and her phone. She told her family that she was going to be back to watch the Dallas Cowboys play the Philadelphia Eagles at 1:30 p.m. The Dallas Cowboys were one of her dad's favorite teams. As always, it was a perfect day for a hike. She started around 6 in the morning. It was sunny and warm, and she was enjoying the solitude and the beauty of the mountains. As she walked, she was listening to some oldies, some Irish songs, and some songs her father apparently made. The air was fresh with the smell of pine needles, and it was just a beautiful day. Ruth is a deeply religious person, and she said she saw and felt her creator everywhere. She arrived at the Ice House Saddle at 8:30 a.m., and this is where the trail leads up to the summit. She sent a quick text to her family, just letting them know. what her timeline was. She sent some photos and she arrived at the summit around 9 to 9:30. She spent some time up there, about 25 minutes, just enjoying the solitude before she decided to head back down. So the trail, there were a lot of switchbacks. It's pretty steep and it was covered intermittently in ankle deep snow over just certain portions. Everything was going fine, but then she reached an area that started to make her nervous. She just didn't have that much traction on her shoes, and she stopped enjoying the walk completely. She realized that she was in trouble. She put her phone and her headphones away, and she started gripping really tightly on her hiking poles. And this was her last memory. She has fear, and then she's putting her things away, and then she fell approximately 200 feet down the trail. And she impacted a tree, which is what stopped her fall.
That's amazing. 200 feet. Just a sliding fall on the ice, I'm guessing, or the snowpack.
When Ruth came to, she was looking at the faces of some concerned hikers, which included a man and an older couple. One of the onlookers had called search and rescue from an emergency beacon. But shortly after awakening, Ruth heard a helicopter flying overhead, and her first concern was the cost of transport. And at that time, she thought, I can get down all by myself. I don't need this helicopter. Ruth was finally able to assess her injuries, and she started having second thoughts about self-arrest at that point. She had cuts on her hands and face. She had a gash on her head that was showing bone. She also had 2 broken vertebrae in her neck, but she didn't know that at the time. It took 2 hours for her to be rescued by helicopter. The early one apparently wasn't for her. Thankfully, one of the hikers that came to her aid put a ski hat on her head, and they covered her with emergency blankets, and Ruth iced her head with some of the snow, so at that point must have been a little bit more with it. One of the hikers used his bright orange hat to alert the helicopter to their location, but unfortunately there were strong winds that made landing very difficult. The helicopter attempted to drop a cable a few times, but they were just struggling. A rescuer actually rappelled down to tell Ruth that they would have to evacuate her from a different spot. Ruth was struggling with pain, especially from her neck. She supported her neck with her hands and prayed, "Have mercy on me here. Now, please help me." Due to the wind conditions, the helicopter had to pick Ruth up from 200 feet down the trail. She had to walk 200 feet down the trail while holding her neck. The time was about 2 p.m., and the last time she had checked her phone to see or watch to see what time it was 10 a.m. My guess is that she checked the time right before she put her phone away, immediately before her fall. And at this point, remember, her family was expecting her back at 1:30 for the football game. Once she was placed safely in the helicopter, she did reach out to her family, and they had already left the campground to look for her.
Yeah.
Upon hearing the news, her sister said that they were shocked and devastated to find out what had happened to her. A sheriff's office statement notes, quote, "The rescuer, who was equipped with crampons and an ice axe, hiked to her location and assessed her condition." They also said that during her fall, she had started going feet first, but somehow during that fall, she had transitioned to going head first, which explains a neck injury and a head injury. Ruth was flown to a hospital and she spent 5 nights in the ICU. She needed 40 stitches and staples on her scalp and stitches under her nose and under her mouth. She underwent surgery for her broken cervical vertebrae that included screws and plates. And in regard to her neck, she said, "It was definitely one of those moments that hits you hard, like I could be paralyzed." She also had a torn ligament in her or ligaments in her leg. She had to be in a neck brace for 5 weeks following surgery, although she knew she had to take it easy. She just knew that she was so lucky and said, "The joy and gratitude of being alive and being able to walk and talk just far, far outweighs it." She attributes her survival to her faith in God and believes that her prayer saved her life.
The next story involves Lauren Elder. Lauren went for a sightseeing flight that would change the way she thought about flying forever and highlights the importance of wearing underwear.
Our story starts on April 26th, 1976. Lauren climbed into the backseat of this 4-seater Cessna 182P Skylane. The pilot named Jay Fuller and his girlfriend Jean Noller were sitting in the front seats. Lauren, who was 29 at the time, she had been invited to go on the sightseeing trip after her boyfriend, Jim Fizdale, backed out of the opportunity at the last minute because he had to pick up this shift at work. Jim worked in the vet's clinic. There was nothing that I found that really indicated how close she was to the couple in the plane, but I don't think she knew them very well. The plan was to fly from the Oakland airport to Furnace Creek Airport in Death Valley, which... okay, come on. That just sounds ominous, don't you think? Furnace Creek Airport. Creek.
No thanks.
And it's in Death Valley.
A hard pass for me.
Yeah. Furnace Creek initially opened in 1942 as Furnace Creek Landing Field. It was a military owned field. The military abandoned it in 1945 and it became a small civilian airfield in 1953. So this group in the plane, they were looking forward to taking some aerial photographs of the Sierra Mountains, and they were going to picnic at Furnace Creek and then turn around and head back in the afternoon. So we've talked about the Sierra Nevada Range before, but I was just going to give you a little bit of background on it again. So the Sierra Nevada is a mountain range located in the western United States. It extends from the southern part of California to the northern part of Nevada. It stretches approximately 400 miles from north to south, making it one of the longest mountain ranges in the U.S. The range is known for its high elevation. The average elevation of the Sierra Nevada exceeds 11,000 feet, or 3,353 meters, with many of the peaks reaching well above 12,000 feet. I mean, those are some tall mountains.
Yeah, that is an impressive mountain range, both in geography covered and also elevation.
So back to our story, the pilot Jim was a 36-year-old male. He had 213 flight hours, 46 on type, which I wonder if that's flying within the mountains. I'm not sure. And he wasn't instrument rated, but skill and distance are hard to judge when flying over large mountains. Regardless of how many hours you have, this is going to be potentially difficult. And I'll get into that a little bit later with wind patterns. As it always seems in these stories, it was a beautiful, clear day. And they were enjoying their time in the air, but Lauren may have noted some warning signs. In the aftermath of this story, it was suspected that the pilot was following Bubbs Creek to Kearsage Pass, which is a well-known route that would lead them safely to Furnace Creek without having to go over any large mountains. But I want you to take a guess, Julie, at what actually happened. Do you think that they went that way, the safe way, the safe and boring way?
Well, I'm going to guess one of two things. First guess, he thought he was following Bubbs Creek, but it was actually a different creek. Second guess, he decided spontaneously or impulsively to change route and try something different that wasn't part of his original plan. Am I right?
Yeah, well, what I will tell you is he didn't go the way that they originally had planned or maybe should have gone. He ended up flying southeast to Center Basin, which is flanked by three peaks, which are between 13,000 and 14,000 feet, with ridges of 12,500 feet.
Yeah, that's a real just like rim of rock.
Right. In Lauren Elder's book, which is titled And I Alone Survived, which gives a lot away about this story before we get into it.
Spoiler alert.
Elder apparently wrote, quote, I felt a kind of thrill at our daring. Jay was having a wonderful time slipping the little plane through these valleys and massive mountains, acting like guide to two thoroughly engrossed women. But part of the problem in the decision-making could have been related to lack of oxygen. Supplemental oxygen is required by the FAA for pilots over 12,500 feet for over 30 minutes and at all times above 14,000 feet. So the lack of oxygen can lead to euphoria, numbness and tingling, vision changes, of course, poor decision making.
Yeah, definitely. Cognitive dysfunction, high altitude cerebral edema, pulmonary edema, all the things.
Yep, exactly. So who knows how much that played into it, but they were really getting up there to the end spectrum of what the plane could even handle in terms of altitude. Elder recalled the pilot calling out, "Get ready for a fantastic view when we clear the crest." And at that moment, there was a sudden downdraft. And with the downdraft comes the deceleration. And the pilot was not able to recover in time for what came next. Elder was looking backwards out the window. She'd been taking photos. And she actually had unbelted herself. She was not buckled in. She was just taking photographs and lost in what she was doing. At one point, she redirects her line of sight towards the front of the plane and sees this wall of granite imminently moving towards them.
Terrifying.
And get this, the plane crashed into the wall 15 feet below the summit. 15 feet. Like, that's really not very far away.
No, that's so close. They almost had it.
Almost. When Elder awoke, she was in a crumpled plain on the side of the mountain that was essentially broken in half, only a few feet from a ridge.
It sounds like she had a period of unconsciousness, at least for some extent of time.
Right. Jay, the pilot, crawled out of the wreckage. His girlfriend was unconscious at the time. She had a severe head injury and a slashed face. Jay and Lauren removed her from the aircraft. Lauren collected drippings of fuel after emptying some beer bottles to light for warmth. They didn't have anything to burn, so they just poured the fuel on surrounding rocks and set it on fire. Jay worked on the radio to activate the emergency beacon. As Noller, the girlfriend, was lying on the ground, she was, according to Elder, quote, strong and unruly, moaning and whining, anguish sounds. She then began convulsing and slipped down the mountain slope out of the line of sight of Elder and Fuller.
Oh, that's awful. That's so sad.
I know. Can you imagine? Just thinking about being in that situation to begin with, so shocking. And then to have to watch that, knowing that you can't do anything. There's nothing to be done.
Yeah, nothing to be done. Oh, it's horrible.
Jay was distraught, and he told Elder that he had done a dumb thing, really dumb. He was telling her that he should have circled. He should have made another approach to gain altitude because of the downdrafts. I guess the reason that pilots circle is to get 1 to 2,000 feet of clearance before crossing a ridge, but he would have needed more altitude, which was greater than the abilities of the aircraft. During the night, the wind blew out the fire that they had on the rocks. And so Elder moved some of these rocks to the tail of the plane. And then she and Fuller curled up in the tail of the plane together. They were lying there silently when Fuller started thrashing about, pounding his fists and his head inside the plane. And then he finally stopped moving and Elder fell back asleep. Just like, what in the world was going on here?
Yeah. Is that like an insidious head injury maybe?
Yeah, that's what I kind of went. In the morning, Elder noted that Fuller was motionless. He had thrown off all of his clothing and his coverings in the night. And so it was thought that he died of hypothermia. But he also had a head injury and a head gash and potentially some other internal injuries. So it's hard to say. But remember, we've talked about the effects of temperature on people that have blood loss. So he could have had internal bleeding or something like that that accelerated his hypothermia.
Yeah. Yeah. With a lot of internal blood loss, a person could get hypothermic on an 80 degree day. If it's colder than 98.6 degrees, maybe not 80 degrees, but whatever the threshold for hypothermia is, we'll say 75. But yeah, that blood loss, internal bleeding just totally diminishes your ability to thermoregulate.
Yeah. I just love it when you're dramatic, Julie. I know.
Prone to exaggerating a little.
In the morning when Elder had noted that Fuller was motionless and that he had passed away, she just sat there watching him for a while. She said, quote, I sat there a long time looking at him. His eyes were open and staring. I had not known that was what it was like to die.
Wow.
So heavy. Lots of trauma. Yeah, between the crash and then the girlfriend dying and then the pilot dying, it's all pretty unsettling.
Yeah.
So Elder warmed herself on a ridge and she tried to decide if she should await rescue. At that time, she saw a plane and could not get its attention despite her frantic waving. And after that experience, the question of what she needed to do was answered. She knew she had to walk out. She couldn't wait there. The temperature was too cold. The altitude was 12,500 feet, which was 1/2 mile south of Mount Bradley. Mount Bradley is just north of Mount Whitney. Julie, this next part will leave you chilled.
Okay, I'm already chilled with the 12,500 feet.
Okay, Elder had on a blouse, a wraparound skirt, and 2-inch heeled boots.
No, heeled boots. Oh,
yes, but that's disaster. Not the worst. That is not part that's a disaster. This is the worst part. She didn't put underwear on that morning because she said, quote, I was in a rush and had no clean underwear that day. Just what mothers warn you not to do.
Oh, Yeah. Mothers say, wear clean underwear, because if you run into an accident, you don't want them to find you with anything but clean underwear on.
I would say it's just wear the dirty underwear. Wear underwear, I guess, is the moral of the story.
Yeah, turn it inside out, you know? There's solutions to those problems. Get creative. I have to say, though, Casey, if I had to choose between not wearing underwear and wearing 2-inch heels, or not wearing 2-inch heels and wearing underwear, I would choose the no underwear. I would not want the 2-inch heels. I'm like visualizing that on a scree field.
Just think about the wind in locations like this, though. You know, it's just blowing right up her skirt the whole time.
Yeah, that's true.
When Lauren didn't return at the intended time, her boyfriend became concerned. And actually, the pilot had a daughter, Carla, who was only 10 years old. She was home alone.
Oh gosh, and that's horrible.
I know. I can't imagine. I guess it's only for the day, but I still can't imagine leaving my kid at home for the day while I went on a flying spree. But thankfully, he didn't invite the daughter. That would have been treacherous.
Yeah, that's true.
She sounded the alarm bells and called Elder's boyfriend, Fizdale, who went to Fuller's house, and he began making calls to airfields and the search and rescue. At 2:24 a.m. on Tuesday, FAA had issued an alert, and at least a dozen pilots with the Civil Air Patrol and Air Force Rescue Center were in the air searching. Mm. Lauren began descending diagonally across this granite face because the eastern edge drops at a 45-degree angle, and sometimes it's even steeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
She had to avoid thoughts of pain and cold and move on all four, kind of doing a sideways spider walk, using her boots and fists to make handholds and toeholds in crusted snow. Her movements helped keep her warm, but here's the part about not wearing underwear. As we mentioned before, she said, quote, "A gust of cold air blew up my skirt, billowing my wraparound and chilling my bare behind. I yelped, but held on," end quote.
Oh, boy.
About a third of the way down the incline, it was not as steep, and she was able to slide down the snowy slope on her skirt, and she'd made it through the most difficult part of her journey at that point. By mid-morning, she was able to stand and sidestep, but now she was in knee-deep snow, so I'm sure her feet were completely wet. Fizdale had called Elder's dad, Robert, who's a World War II Navy pilot. He was also the director of flight test operations at Northrop Aviation in LA. He sent a plane to help. During this time, rescue pilots saw wreckage, but they did not see any sign of life. In the late afternoon, Elder removed her boots that were totally annihilated. She drank from a pool at the bottom of a waterfall, and she began walking in the stream. I'm sure that she was pretty thirsty at that point.
Yeah.
She kept moving on and started noticing that she was hallucinating. She was thinking that she was seeing houses that turned out to be big rocks, and she thought she was seeing people that turned out to be reeds or plants when she got closer to them. When she finally got down, she ended up in Independence, California. She had ripped clothing, was barefoot, and was covered in blood. I read something that indicated that she had trouble getting help initially because she was looking rough and tumbled. Her teeth were smashed. Of course, she had probably blood all over herself. She had a broken arm. She didn't have shoes on. But apparently the reason that people were potentially a little bit hesitant to approach her was because this was the town where Charles Manson and his female followers were arrested 7 years.
Oh, wow. What are the chances? That's wild.
On April 27th at 10 p.m., 34 hours after taking off from Oakland, and after 10 miles of descending and 10 more miles of walking, she was admitted to Lone Pine Hospital. She had blistered feet, mild frostbite on her feet, and a broken arm. The rescue team found Noller's body 120 feet below the Cessna, and Fuller's body was half outside the plane, dusted with snow.
Mm.
3 months after this incident, Lauren hiked with a friend back to the crash site. Her arm was still in a cast. She said in an interview, quote, "I had to go back. I felt like the mountain had some kind of power over me." I was just going to chat briefly about Lauren and what she ended up doing after the fact. After the crash, she chronicled her experiences in a book. Really, she co-authored a book titled "And I Alone Survived." This book offered her first-person account of her story. But her story didn't end there. Her survival story continued to resonate with audiences, and it was adapted into a TV movie of the same title. And then the Discovery Channel aired a documentary about the crash. The official investigation of the crash, led by National Transportation Safety Board, delivered its verdict. It concluded that the accident was primarily caused by the pilot in command, who continued flight into known areas of severe turbulence. Our next segment will make you fill your water bottle out of thirst as we travel to the Sahara.
We will be discussing Mauro Prosperi's story, a man who is nicknamed the Robinson Crusoe of the desert when he was lost in the Sahara for 9 days, all alone and with limited provisions. Mauro Prosperi was born in the capital city of Rome on July 13, 1955. He started working for the police department, the National Police Force of Italy, as a crowd control police officer atop a horse in Catalina. Italy's police federation subsidized training of national caliber athletes, and I think this is what motivated him to take this job. It allowed him to do what he wanted to do, which was actually the modern pentathlon.
What's a pentathlon?
This is something that actually happens in the Olympics, or it did at one point. The modern pentathlon is an event comprised of pistol shooting, fencing, swimming, horseback riding, and running. So basically, you have to be very skilled in many areas.
You know, I always thought that shooting was a big crossover.
The agility, Tessa.
Yes. Yeah, you have to have many skills. Good hand-eye coordination. See, it all fits together.
Exactly. He met his wife. Her name was Cinza. They met at a pre-Olympic pentathlon event when she was working as an English and Russian language interpreter. They actually had 3 children together. And what she liked about him was because he was really enthusiastic towards overcoming obstacles. He found out about the marathon disables from one of his friends. And this is the marathon that kind of tipped this whole trip off to the Sahara Desert. So in a statement to the BBC, Prosperi states, What I like most about running extreme marathons is the fact that you come into close contact with nature. The races take place in beautiful settings such as mountains, deserts, glaciers. As a professional athlete, I hadn't been able to enjoy these surroundings because I was so focused on winning medals. I found out about the marathon disables by chance. I'd already retired from the pentathlon when a good friend said to me, there's this amazing marathon in the desert, but it's very tough. I love a challenge, so I started training immediately, running 40 kilometers, 25 miles a day, reducing the amount of water I was drinking to get used to the dehydration. I was never home. There were over 100 applicants when Prosperi did this. And this is 1994, by the way. But there were only 80 participants. And so today, there's something like 1,200 French and foreign participants. I want to tell you a little bit about the race. So the Marathon des Sables is a 7-day race through the Moroccan Sahara. It's the equivalent of running 6 marathons in a row, which is 155 miles or 250 kilometers, all while using self-support. So you have to carry your food and sleeping gear.
What about water?
They have to carry their water in their packs, but they provide water at each checkpoint. Water stops are located throughout each stage of the race. And so there are 2 to 6 checkpoints, depending on the length of the race for the day. And each competitor must go through those water checkpoints. Otherwise, you're dinged or maybe disqualified. Water allotments range, depending upon the stage, from 12 liters. So they said liaison stage, which I don't know what that is really, is 12 liters. Marathon stage is 15 liters per person per day, and the nonstop stage is 25.5 liters per day. The Marathon des Sables is organized by the Atlantide Organization Internationale, and so it is a 10-day race. So on their website now, they're saying, again, 1,200 French and foreign participants. Anyone meeting these following conditions are accepted. So over 18, any citizenship, medical certification, issued by the organization stating their ability to participate in a resting EKG. Due to the nature of the race, the organization is obliged to advise participants to take out their own accident and death insurance. In an interview with the BBC in 2014, Prosperi noted that there was a form you had to sign that specifies where you want your body to be sent if you perish.
I wonder how common it is to die during a race in the desert.
It's funny that you ask that because I was about to tell you.
I love it.
So the promoters of the race have called it the toughest foot race on earth. However, the only one contestant perished at the point at which Prosperi went on this race. And that was a French runner who died of a massive heart attack in 1988. So no one else had gone missing and nothing bad had happened to anyone at this point.
They were just covering their bases.
So Prosperi competed in 1994, as I said before. He was alone for the majority of the beginning of the race because there are 80 participants and many of them were not running. And he's very, very driven, especially with his history of competition. Mm-hmm. He wants to get to the finish line. It's important to him. So this is the fourth day of the marathon. It's the longest single stage of the race. And it's a distance of 57 miles between campsites in the desert. And it's ending at this place called Zagora, which is a Berber village in the Palm Draw Valley. On April 14th, the day of the race, the temperatures reached 115 degrees at the point of which Prosperi passed the third checkpoint, 20 miles into the day's journey, where he picked up his 2-liter ration of water around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. His friend Giovanni Manzo helped him tape his blister on his foot. And so this is actually the person who had told him about the race in the first place. Mm-hmm. 15 minutes after he left the checkpoint, the wind really started kicking up and it worked its way into this blinding sandstorm with basically zero visibility. The marathoners on the course were forced to wrap themselves in sleeping bags to ride out the storm. The sand, it stings the skin, can cause bloody noses and respiratory tract abrasions. And mm-hmm. I would imagine that it would cause skin abrasions too. It's probably terrible. Mm-hmm. The storm lasted for 6 hours.
So do they just hunker down for that whole 6 hours?
From what I understand, that's what they're supposed to do. That's what the organizers tell them, that if you get stuck in a sandstorm, you need to stay exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. And I think you can be disqualified if you actually do leave that point because it's a safety issue. And actually today you have to have a spot device, a satellite device, because of this story that we're getting into. For good reason.
Because of Prosperi.
Yes. So again, it lasted for 6+ hours. And that evening, officials became concerned when Manzo came in the fourth checkpoint without any signs of Prosperi, who'd been, again, running in front of him and should have finished hours earlier. However, the race officials trusted that Prosperi wouldn't have strayed very far. So they decided to initiate a full-scale search in the morning if he didn't show up over the course of the night. The next day at daybreak, when he hadn't showed up still, the race employees were dispatched in Land Rovers to search the trail, and a pilot did a flyover. They covered the terrain in a grid-like pattern, and their concern was about his water supply because he had at most 2 liters of water. And so by the noon temperatures, remember, the smallest amount of water that they gave to these participants was 12.5 liters, up to, over 20. So he has 2, maybe. Anyway, they covered the grid pattern. And because of his water supply, again, they were concerned. And it was supposed to be triple digits by noon that day. The Moroccan military joined the search later in the morning using Bedouin trackers and a helicopter. And they worked all day and all night. Prosperi was missing for over 2 days before his wife heard the news. And guess how she found out?
Through the news?
Yes. The newspaper.
Yeah, that's not great.
No. So at this point, Prosperi's brother, Ricardo, and 2 Interpol investigators from Rome and Prosperi's brother-in-law, Fabio, organized a search effort of their own. The Italian authorities became involved in the search. Officials in Rome and Italy's embassy in Morocco provided funds and vehicles. So it's like a huge undertaking to find this guy.
How long into it are we now?
2 days.
Okay, just still 2 days. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the largest rescue attempts in the Sahara. After 1982, there was a 1982 search for Mark Thatcher, son of then Prime Minister's Margaret Thatcher, who was lost 6 days after his car broke down during the Paris-Dakar rally. On Sunday, April 17, racers crossed the finish line at Zagora, and there was a banquet held the next day, but it seemed like a memorial. At this point, 4 days after his disappearance, there were only Italian volunteers led by Prosperi's brother-in-law, because the authorities were basically calling it futile at that point. And the Moroccan military had never heard of a man surviving over 4 days in the Sahara without water. So it's pretty bleak at this point.
Yeah, and you would think when they have people flying over, they can cover a lot of ground. So for them not to find him.
But if you think about it, the desert is just such a large expanse that it's like finding a needle in a haystack. On April 20th, so this is 6.5 days into this ordeal, they found his water bottle and his aluminum emergency blanket near the Morocco-Algeria border. And so this gave hope to the searchers, which remember, this is just his family basically looking for him at this point. On day 8, one of Prosperity's shoelaces was found, but the situation seemed hopeless at this point, given the amount of time that had passed. Now I'm going to read to you Prosperity's account of his...
what was going on while everyone was searching?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I just felt like his words would probably do it the best justice. So here it is. Suddenly, a very violent sandstorm began. The wind kicked up with a terrifying fury. I was swallowed by a yellow wall of sand. I was blinded. I couldn't breathe. The sand whipped my face. It was like a storm of needles. I understood for the first time how powerful a sandstorm could be. I turned my back on the wind and wrapped the scarf around my face to stop the sandstorm from wounding me. I wasn't disoriented, but I had to keep moving to keep from getting burnt, buried. Eventually, I crouched down into a shelter spot, waiting for the storm to end. It lasted 8 hours. When the wind died down, it was dark, so I slept out there in the dunes. I was upset about the race because until then I had been in fourth place. I thought, oh well, I can't win now, but I can still make good time. Tomorrow morning I'll get up really early and try to finish reach the finish.
Oh my goodness, those priorities.
I know. He's still thinking about, you know, finishing the race at this point. So you have 36 hours to run the stage of the race. Any longer and you're disqualified, which is pretty interesting. So there was still a chance. What I couldn't have imagined was how dramatically that storm would change everything around me. I woke up very early to a transformed landscape. I didn't know I was lost. I had a compass and a map, so I thought I could navigate perfectly well. But without points of reference, it was all a lot more complicated. I wasn't worried because I was knowing sooner or later I'd meet someone. Who knows how many others are in the same situation, I thought. As soon as I see someone, we can team up and we'll finish together. That was my plan, but unfortunately it didn't work out. After running for about 4 hours, I climbed up to a dune and still couldn't see anything. That's when I knew I had a big problem. I started to walk. What was the point of running? Running where? When I realized I was lost, the first thing I did was urinate into my spare water bottle, because when you're still well hydrated, your urine is the clearest and most drinkable. I remember my grandfather telling me how during the war, he and his fellow soldiers had drunk their own urine when their water ran out. I did it as a precaution, but I wasn't desperate. I was sure the organizers would find me soon. When running the marathon to Sables, you have to be self-sufficient, and I was well prepared. I had a knife, a compass, a sleeping bag, and plenty of dehydrated food in my backpack. The problem was water. We were given fresh water at the checkpoints, but when the storm hit, I only had a bottle of water left. I drank it as slowly as I could. I'm very resistant to heat and I was very careful. I would only walk when it was cool early in the morning and then again in the evening. During the day, when I wasn't walking, I'd try to find shelter in the shade. I was wearing two hats, a baseball hat with a red woolen hat on top, to keep the temperature as consistent as possible. Luckily, my skin is quite dark, so I didn't really suffer from sunburn. On the second day at sunset, I heard a sound of a helicopter coming towards me. I assumed it was looking for me, so I took out my flare and shot it in the air, but it didn't see it. It was flying so low that I could see the pilot's helmet, but he didn't see me. It flew right past. The helicopter, on loan from the Moroccan police, was returning to base to refuel. Since 1995, because of my experience, runners have been equipped with the kind of flares they use at sea, which they're not happy about because they weigh 500 grams. But at the time, the flares we had were really small, no bigger than a pen. Nevertheless, I remained calm because I was convinced organizers would have the resources to find anyone lost in the desert. I still thought I'd be rescued sooner or later. After a couple of days, I came across a marabout, a Muslim shrine where Bedouins stop when they are crossing the desert. I was hoping it was inhabited, but unfortunately, there was nobody there, only a holy man in a coffin. But at least I had a roof over my head. It was like being home. I assessed my situation. It wasn't rosy, but I was feeling all right physically. I ate some of my rations, which I cooked with fresh urine, not the bottled urine that I was saving to drink. Nice. I started to drink that on the fourth day. The marabout had filled up with sand, all from the sandstorm, so the ceiling was very low. I went up to the roof to plant my Italian flag in the hopes that anybody looking for me could see it. When I was up there, I saw some bats huddled together in the tower. I decided to drink their blood. So he cut off their heads and mushed up their insides with a knife, then sucked them out. I ate at least 20 of them raw. I only did what they do to their prey. I stayed in the marabout for a few days waiting to be found. I gave into the despair only twice. Once when I saw the helicopter and it didn't see me. The other time when I saw the airplane. I had been in the marabout for about 3 days when I heard the sound of a motor, an airplane. I didn't know if it was looking for me, but I immediately started a fire with whatever I had, the rucksack, everything, and hoped the plane would see the smoke. But just then another sandstorm hit. It lasted for 12 hours. The airplane didn't spot me. It felt like my very last chance to be found. I was depressed. I was convinced I was going to die and that it was going to be an agonizing death. So I wanted to accelerate it. I thought if I died in the desert, no one would find me and my wife can get the police pension in Italy. If somebody goes missing, you have to wait 10 years before they can be declared dead. At least if I died in this Muslim shrine, they wouldn't find my body and my wife would have had the income. What he's saying is that his wife would get paid for 10 years, the income from his police job, because he couldn't be declared dead for 10 years. So he thought, oh, if I die in the desert in this place, I wasn't afraid of dying. And my decision to take my own life came out of logical reasoning rather than despair. I wrote a note to my wife on a piece of charcoal and then cut my wrists. I lay down and waited to die. Like my blood had thickened and wouldn't drain. That's how dehydrated he is.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that could happen.
I didn't either. So the following morning I woke up. I hadn't managed to kill myself. Death didn't want me yet. I took it as a sign. I regained confidence and I decided that to see it as a new competition against myself. I became determined and focused again. I was thinking for my children. I put myself in order. Moro, the athlete, was back. I needed to have a plan. I still had quite a lot of energy left. I wasn't tired. As a former pentathlete, I was used to training 12 hours a day, and I had trained for the marathon disables, so I didn't feel too weak. I still had energy tablets, too. So I regained my strength and mental lucidity. I decided to go to the shrine and get walking again, but where to? I followed the advice that the Tuareg had given us before we started the race. If you're lost, head for the clouds that you can see on the horizon at dawn. This is where you will find life. So I decided to head for those mythical clouds on the horizon. I walked in the desert for days, killing snakes and lizards and eating them raw. In that way, I drank too. I think there are some instincts, a kind of deja vu, that kick in an emergency situation. My inner caveman emerged. I was aware that I was losing an incredible amount of weight. The more I walked, the looser my watch felt on my wrist. I was so dehydrated I couldn't urinate anymore. And luckily, I had some anti-diarrheal medication, which I kept taking. I wanted to see my family and friends again, and I concentrated on that. I wasn't afraid. At the same time, I started to view the desert as a place where people can live. I could see the beauty of the desert. I paid careful attention to every trace. Even dried excrement gave me clues about what direction to go in. I learned that there was food all around you if you learned to look. I was walking through the desert. I recognized a dried riverbed where succulents grew. So I squeezed the juice out and drank that. I started to think of myself as a man of the desert. Later, a Tuareg prince dedicated a poem to me. According to him, I was the chosen one because I survived so long in the desert. Meanwhile, the organizers were out looking for me. My brother and brother-in-law had flown from Italy to join the search. They found some of the traces I'd left behind, like my shoelaces. They got to the marabout and found signs of me, but they were sure they were only looking for a body. On the eighth day, I came to a little oasis. I lay down and drank, sipping slowly, for about 6 or 7 hours. I saw a footprint in the sand, so I knew people couldn't be far.
Ah, that's the Robinson Crusoe bit. It's because he knew that there were people on the island because of a footprint.
Oh.
Things are falling into place.
The next day, I saw some goats in the distance. It gave me hope. Then I saw a young shepherd girl. She saw me too and ran away scared. After 9 days in the desert, I must have looked quite a sight. I was black with dirt. The girl ran towards the large Berber tent and to warn the woman I was coming. There were no men in the camp. They had all gone to market. But the women took care of me. They were so kind. The older woman came out of the tent and immediately gave me some goat's milk to drink. She tried to give me some foods as well, but I threw it up. They wouldn't allow me into the tent because I'm a man, but they put me on the carpet in the shade of their veranda. They sent someone to call the police. They like to camp close to military bases for protection. The police came and carried me to their jeep. They took me to their military base, blindfolded because they didn't know who I was. They thought I might be dangerous. They had guns, and I thought at times they were going to kill me. When they found out I was the marathon runner who'd gotten lost in Morocco, they took off my blindfold and celebrated. I discovered that I had crossed the border into Algeria.
Oh my goodness.
I was 291 kilometers, 181 miles off course.
Holy cow.
Yep. They took me to a hospital in Tindouf, where finally after 10 days, I was able to call my wife. The first thing I said to her was, "Have you already had my funeral? Because after 10 days in the desert, you would expect someone to be dead." When they weighed me at the hospital, I had lost 16 kilograms, 35 pounds. I weighed just 45 kilograms, 99 pounds. My eyes had suffered and my liver was damaged, but my kidneys were fine. I couldn't eat anything other than super liquids for months. It took me almost 2 years to recover. So then he went back 4 years later to do this race again. But when he got to the hospital, they gave him 16 liters of IV fluids and he was near liver failure. But after a day and a half, that's when he called his home. And he stayed another 7 days in the hospital. And then he was sent home to Rome and he was treated like he was a hero in this walking miracle and like he rose from the dead. And he was celebrated in newspapers everywhere. Shortly after he arrived home, people were starting to doubt his story because this is the longest anyone had ever been in the desert. And the organizers of the Marathon des Sables accused him of fraud. And Prosperi considered a lawsuit against the Patrick Bauer. Patrick Bauer is the main guy. He's the one that started this race in the first place. He ended up dropping this lawsuit because he felt like it was a personal conflict and not a legal one. Mm-hmm. Later, a Roman film crew retraced the steps for a 1995 documentary, and they found the shrine and some of his belongings and bat skeletons. Another thing is he stuck to every single detail of the story every time that he's told it. It's never changed. Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know why you would do that, besides maybe the publicity of it all, but that even seems a little wild.
Yeah, maybe a little extreme, maybe a day or two being lost, but 9 days is a little.
And committing to the fact where you only weigh 99 pounds.
And you have liver damage.
Lastly, today we will be headed to the top of the world to talk about Lincoln Hall, who had a brush with death on Everest and lived, his survival defying the laws of nature and science.
I'm excited to share the story that I have with you. We're going to the top of Mount Everest today. We are going to get to the summit. The question is, are we going to make our way back down?
That's the hard part.
That is always the hard part. Another fact about deaths on Everest, the majority of deaths are on descent. Between 80 and 90% of Everest deaths are on descent and much smaller number of deaths associated with us. One of the particulars of the climbing season of 2006 is that they had a really long, unusually long weather span where the mountain was accessible. But usually there's only about a 2 week window every year that allows access to climbing. But this particular season, the window was a lot longer, which just allowed for more climbers, more summit attempts, more traffic on the mountain.
More traffic and increased risk for something bad to happen.
So this particular story is fairly well known. I'm guessing that some of our listeners may already be familiar with the tale of Lincoln Hall. He's an Australian mountaineer who has some major ascents under his belt by the time he got to Mount Everest in 2006. He did a first ascent of a mountain called Mount Minto in Antarctica in 1988. And he'd climbed Makalu and Annapurna and a mountain called Dunagiri in the years leading up to his Everest attempt. So he had a lot of experience. He was an experienced mountaineer, 30 years actually under his belt. He'd summited many peaks, but he had never summited Mount Everest. In 2006, he was invited to join an expedition, again on the north side of Everest, and a pretty risky route as well. Everest is 29,000 feet high, the highest, obviously, elevation of a mountain in the world. And on the summit, at that elevation, there's about 30% of the air is oxygen and what's in comparison to what's available at sea level. So the altitude and the lack of oxygen is really what makes Everest technically difficult. It's not that the climbing is so dangerous, although it is. I'm not being cavalier about that. But the altitude is what really makes it challenging. And anything above 22,000 feet in terms of levels of oxygen in the environment would be considered the death zone, not compatible with life for a prolonged period of time. Another factor possibly working against Lincoln Hall at this point in his life is that the statistic climbers over the age of 50 are at least twice likely to die on Everest. And Lincoln Hall had just turned 50 that year. So he was in the second half of life. And apparently that doesn't work in your favor. At this point in his life, Lincoln Hall is married to his wife, Barbara, back in Australia. He has two teenage sons. And he had spent about 2 months with his team acclimatizing to prepare for this climb on Everest. So each climber had paid about $15,000 to join this 20-person expedition, which was run by a Russian mountaineer named Alex Abramov. He was their team leader. And there had already been 9 deaths on the mountain that year, which is a lot. It was a lot. But at the time, that was the most deaths per year that Everest had ever seen. It's consistently gone up since then. And I think 2023 is now the year with the most deaths. But that's purely just a reflection of the increase of volume of climbers. Lincoln Hall felt surrounded by death. And to add to that, just before he attempted his summit bid, there was a 10th death. And it was a member of his own team, a Russian mountaineer by the name of Igor Plyushkin, who is similar age, similar experience level, very experienced, perished on the mountain. So now we're up to 10. It was late in the season by the point that Lincoln Hall and his partner Thomas Weber, who was a German climber, were attempting the summit. Most of the climbers that season had already made their way up and were starting to head home. But Lincoln and Thomas and their Sherpa guides were still on the way up and progressing towards the higher camps, Camp 2, Camp 3, and then the summit. So on the way up, they passed Igor's icy grave. They saw his dead body in the snow. He had died 2 days before they ran into him, which also was quite unnerving. Their 3 Sherpa companions who they were with at this point were experienced and actually very used to encountering remains on the mountain. There's a Buddhist belief that consciousness leaves the body over a 3-day period after death. So they don't like to move any remains from where they died for that time period. And of course, nobody's going to hang out on Everest for 3 days and wait. So most victims of the mountain just end up laying where they fall and kind of being preserved indefinitely in this icy, visible grave. Lincoln is feeling thrown after he encounters Igor's body on the mountain. He's feeling a little off balance, as you would. So he had a satellite phone. He called his wife, and she knew that he'd always carried this disappointment of not achieving his dream on Everest for the first time 22 years ago. She was kind of on the edge of her seat, hoping for the best, but also worried, as any spouse would be. He didn't reach her when he called her, so he left her a message just describing that he was feeling well, the weather was good. It was an all systems go mentality to leave that night at midnight for their summit bid. On May 24th, 2006, at midnight, he finds himself at 27,000 feet, kind of the point of no return, very near the summit. This is after 4 days of just solid climbing. And at that elevation, with the limited amount of oxygen availability, your survival just depends on speed. It's a get in, get out operation. Only about 3,000 kilometers vertical elevation to go up, spend a minute or two on the summit, 15 or 20, take a few pictures, and then right back down. The key now is really speed. They leave by headlamp in the middle of the night at midnight to try and maximize daylight. And as they're making the final push, suddenly he encounters another victim of the mountain. This time it's the body of British climber David Sharp, who had died 10 days earlier on the mountain. He's frozen solid, very near the summit. And this is a kind of a high profile, interesting peek into the world of Everest mountaineering. This was reported about a lot in the media. And this is, you know, in 2006, we're starting to hear stories of what the climbing culture is like on a busy mountain like this. And David Sharp was sort of the poster boy for those stories. He was climbing Everest with a non-traditional approach. He did not have a Sherpa guide. He had no contact with other expeditions. He had no radio. He was just on his own. And he started to succumb to altitude illness on his way up and couldn't go any farther. He crawled into a shallow cave, and as many as 40 other climbers walked past him as he lay dying on their way up the mountain. most of those climbers didn't see him, or maybe assumed he was resting, or some assumed he was already dead. But nonetheless, they all passed him by. And then the next morning, many climbers passed him on their descent. He was still alive and now quite visible in daylight. And most of the returning climbers noticed him, saw him, and passed him. So media really reacted to this, of course. It was reported on a lot and pointed out as this perceived heartless culture. And even Sir Edmund Hillary, who was one of the first people to summit Mount Everest back in the day, commented that the ethics of mountaineering had been corrupted, that this type of thing was happening.
And also the number of people that are going up there is astronomically higher than it used to be.
Many folks would say that it wouldn't have been physically possible to rescue David Sharp. He couldn't walk at that altitude. Your muscles don't work. You can't lift a nearly dead body and carry him. So I think a lot of people that might have been in that experience firsthand would have suggested that there was no chance of bringing him down, that it really wasn't an option.
There's a lot of limitations.
Yeah, a lot of limitations. So maybe at that point, the choice is just sitting with somebody as they die and holding their hand or summiting, because you wouldn't have enough oxygen to do both. Lincoln and his group passed David Sharp. They reached the second step, which is considered by some to be the biggest obstacle on the climb. The route that they were on, a 150-foot vertical rock wall. They were making pretty good progress. 9 hours into their day, they did reach the summit. They could see it in the distance. They saw prayer flags on the peak, and they knew they would make it. They just had one little last steep section to go before the summit, and then they're standing on the tippy top of Mount Everest. Nobody else was there, and it was just really an incredible moment for Lincoln and the rest of his group. But he was cognizant of the fact that he really was only halfway there. Back at base camp, he had a lot of old friends and climbing partners that heard that they made it. Their leader, Alex Abramoff, got on the radio and directed them to start their descent and just make their way back down. They called his wife. They let her know that he'd made it to the summit. But she later commented that although she appreciated the call, that wasn't the call she wanted. She wanted to hear when he made it back down. That was really the moment she was going to be able to breathe more easily.
Yeah. Can you imagine waiting for that news all day long?
Yeah. I think that would be challenging to just sit and twiddle your thumbs to hear, especially knowing the risks involved and knowing that he'd been in this situation before. So after about 20 minutes on the summit, they began their descent, and 150 feet below them was Thomas Weber still ascending. So they had started out together, but Lincoln Hall made it to the summit before Thomas. Thomas Weber had decided to turn back. He was losing his balance. His cognition was declining, and he was showing signs of severe altitude illness. And then suddenly, as Lincoln Hall was descending, he out of nowhere started to feel just incredibly exhausted. He described it as letting his mental guard down, feeling really fatigued, lethargic, and recognized that he was showing the signs of HACE, high altitude cerebral edema, which is not super well understood severe altitude illness that is related to low pressure in the atmosphere causing fluid to leak into the brain, which then causes pressure within the cranium, swelling within the cranium. Descent is the only cure for this. It's hallmarked by lethargy, imbalance, confusion, hallucinations can occur. And it did, in this case, come on quite quickly. So meanwhile, Thomas Weber and his guide, 150 feet below, radioed that Thomas had suddenly died. This was unexpected because he had turned back and they thought he was headed in the right direction. But apparently he sat down in the snow and he looked at his guide and said, "I am dying." And then he just lay down and quickly died, like a strange premonition came over him. So things got really scary really quickly. And they were still very high up on the mountain. And when their leader, Alex Abramoff, back at base camp, realized that Lincoln was also in trouble, he told Thomas Weber's Sherpa to go back up to try and help Lincoln if he could. So Thomas's Sherpa, Pemba, started to climb back up to where Lincoln and the other two Sherpas were trying to descend. The Sherpas were also struggling, as anyone would. And Lincoln Hall, in retrospect, commented about how he was being very uncooperative, disoriented, combative, irritable, which are all hallmarks of HACE. It's not anything other than malfunction of the brain that can just cause somebody to have really irrational, uncooperative behavior, as can occur in any head injury.
So how long do you have to descend before you have life-ending consequences of HACE? Do you know?
Yeah, I think it's pretty variable. It can come on quite quickly. In fact, I think it's known to come on more quickly than some of the other altitude illnesses like HAPE or AMS. So it can hit fast and probably kill you fast as well. But the good news is you can relieve some of these symptoms with a descent as small as 1,000 feet of elevation. Just going down a short distance can make a difference. So recognizing it and turning it around, or turning around and heading downward, it doesn't take much for some of that to improve. In his state of what they call altitude craziness, the Sherpas tried to lift and carry him to safety, which was impossible with his kind of uncooperative nature. They just weren't making any headway. He had friends in base camp who would get on the radio and try to inspire him to keep moving and keep going and remind him where he was and remind him of his family. And they're all working together to try and inspire him downward. But by this point, Lincoln Hall was really hallucinating and out of it and didn't even really know where he was. The radio urging from his climbing partners, particularly a friend by the name of Mike Dillon, was so persistent that at one point it did get through to him and he realized where he was. He had a moment of lucidity and he was able to take some instructions to try and rappel down this second step, this 150-foot vertical wall, which was crazy because that's a one, you have to do that on your own. Nobody can rappel you or help you with that. So it's a sink or swim operation. And in the state that he was in, everyone just watched helplessly, not knowing if he was going to be able to manage that physical task of rappelling. They called his wife again and told her that he was still near the summit, which was very worrisome to her because this was 6 or 7 hours after they had summited. And she figured that he would be well downward at this point. As he's rappelling, he's out of control, just lowering himself down this rope. And he swung across, pendulumed over to one side with his crampons on. He saw himself headed towards Pemba, the Sherpa guide, and he put his foot out to brace his fall or brace his pendulum swing, forgetting that he had crampons on his boots. And the crampons cut right into Pemba's thigh. It wounded his leg quite badly.
That's awful. And then he has to continue downward with that leg injury and an open wound.
Yes. Pemba had to deal with that in the moment and keep going. He refused to give up on Lincoln. At this point, people will look back on the story and say, well, they should have left him. But the Sherpa guides don't think like that. They were very focused, including Pemba, on getting him down. He had 4 Sherpas helping him at this point, but eventually they had to stop. They weren't making headway. They were dragging him as far as they could, but they were still at 28,000 feet elevation, still in the death zone. They realized there was really nothing else they could do. They'd had a 19-hour day so far. They'd run out of oxygen by this point, and they were all really quite close to death. So, of course, Lincoln's starting to get frostbite. His time has really run out, and the decision is made from base camp to leave him. The Sherpas are directed to head down by Alex Abramoff, the expedition leader. But, of course, they didn't. They stayed with him for an additional 2 hours trying to revive him, trying to do everything they could. But eventually, after that length of time, they couldn't perceive any respirations. They couldn't find a pulse. He didn't respond to a poke in the eye. So they felt pretty confident that he was indeed dead. At 5:20 p.m., remember they left at midnight, so now we're at 5:20 p.m., the Sherpas left him. They left him alone with no water, no shelter, no oxygen. They took a lot of his gear. Nobody has ever been left for dead this high in elevation and survived. His wife reported that at one point in that time frame, she suddenly got this feeling of his arms around her back at home, which felt very troubling, as though he was there with her. And then the phone rang, and she reported that she knew instantly what the phone call was going to tell her. So she told their teenage sons that their dad had passed away about 20 minutes ago, And they three just sat in a huddle, hugging and crying, and really didn't know what to do. The worst fear had come true. And the news spread around the world, the climbing community. He was a fairly well-known climber. Partners, friends, family, memorial plans were already being discussed. And it was a pretty devastating, shocking news in the wake of a lot of other tragedy that had already occurred that year on the mountain. But then the weather changed. The clouds rolled in, which kind of took the edge off the cold and enveloped him. It prevented the temperature from dropping extremely low. And suddenly in the night, Lincoln just wakes up. He's laying there on the mountain, seemingly dead. He woke up and he decided he wasn't going to die. His mind was ready to fight back. The hallucinations were still there. They started up again. He felt like he was wearing what he described as a gray cloak of death. And he knew in his heart that he had to accept this cold and pull that cloak off and keep going. He said he felt like a pilgrim, knowing that he only had one choice. He started to believe he wasn't going to die despite the odds, and he was willing to fight for life. He described using everything he had learned over 30 years of Buddhist meditation and yogic breathing techniques, and of course, mountaineering, to fight. So he maintains his consciousness as the sun comes up, which kind of starts to warm him a little bit. And after 30 hours in this death zone, he should, by all definitions, by all metrics, be dead. And he's awake and conscious. So there he is on his own near the summit. And his luck continues at that point. There was a team of four climbers, Daniel Mazur of the U.S., Andrew Brash of Canada, Miles Osborne of the U.K., and Jangbu Sherpa of Nepal, heading for the summit. And this climbing team of four commented afterwards that they had realized moments before seeing Lincoln Hall that nothing was going to stop them from reaching the summit. They were all but there, which was just an incredible feeling. And then in the next moment, they turn around the proverbial corner and there is Lincoln Hall. He said, "I bet you're surprised to see me here." This team of four, they come across Lincoln Hall and they just knew they had a very difficult choice to make. When they encountered him, he was half undressed. He had taken off the jacket and clothing over his torso, which he commented afterwards might have been a reflection of this cloak of death hallucination he was having. Maybe he was trying to take off his cloak of death. Or another possible explanation is he was in the final throes of hypothermia and doing this phenomenon called paradoxical undressing that we see with hypothermia. When death is imminent and blood suddenly returns to the extremities, it can produce a sensation of a hot rush. So often just before death, hypothermia victims will disrobe, take all their clothes off, or take their mittens off or their jacket off.
So did these climbers assist him in getting his clothing back on? Because it doesn't seem like he would last long without any clothing on.
Yeah, they got him all buttoned back up. They secured him to a rope. He was talking about how he thought he was on a boat. Lincoln Hall thought he was on a boat, and he kept saying he wanted to get off the boat. And to him, getting off the boat was going over this edge of a 10,000 foot drop from where they were. They were really working hard to try and keep him on the boat, so to speak. And they radioed back to base camp that they'd found him and that he was conscious and he was alive. And of course, when that news reached camp, Abramoff dispatched a rescue team of 12 Sherpa guides from the base camp to head back up the mountain. But this team that was on their ascent, they stayed with Lincoln for 4 hours. And they'd run out of oxygen. They knew by making that decision that they would not be able to make it to the summit. It would be too late to continue in the uphill direction. One of the climbers, Miles Osborne, talked about how he had scrimped and saved for years, $25,000 to pay for this expedition. And he knew this was a one-time thing. He was never going to be back there in his lifetime. And he realized that he wasn't going to make it to the summit. He said for about 24 hours, he was so pissed off that his summit bid was ruined. But then he did get the perspective that he absolutely did the right thing. He got famous for it. And Miles Osborne and Lincoln Hall, after the fact, after all of this went down, they ended up becoming friends and really had a lot of respect for each other. So it did end well for both of them. And Miles said he didn't want to go back home and have to tell all of his friends that he walked by this guy when he could have helped, but chose not to. That's not what anybody wants as their legacy. They can't get a hold of Lincoln Hall's family. They're having radio issues, so they're not able to let them know this new development. Several hours go by, and the news is actually starting to spread at this point on the internet. And Lincoln Hall's son back in Australia was surfing the internet and saw a news link that suggested his dad was still alive. They saw this and read it before they got any kind of a phone call. They didn't know what to think. They couldn't believe it. And they just were so confused.
Well, especially in 2006, because news didn't travel like it does now. So that would be pretty shocking to get information that would be contradicting what you had heard before.
Yeah, many people were skeptical, including his family, that this wasn't a scam or a false report. But after 36 hours of fighting, Lincoln Hall arrived back at base camp with this rescue team. He had a lot of frostbite on his hands and toes, and he was able to call his wife, Barbara, himself from base camp. She said that his voice was unrecognizable. And even when she was speaking with him on the phone, she wasn't sure it was him. She still didn't believe it. And then he said to her, "I hope you haven't started looking for another husband yet." And she said that when she heard him say that, she knew it was him. She knew it was him and he was alive and it was all true.
That's hilarious. He has a good sense of humor.
Yeah. So after 2 months on Everest, 22 years after his first attempt, he walked out alive. And his first priority was to try and find the Sherpas that had helped him near the summit. And he was able to find Pemba that day. And they were just so relieved and surprised that he had survived. And Lincoln was so grateful and expressed so much gratitude towards them. And they just kept saying, "Don't worry, don't worry, it's okay." So they had their moment of beauty.
What were Lincoln's injuries, or how much frostbite did he have? Was it pretty significant?
Yeah, it sounds like it was significant on his hands and toes. I don't know how many fingers he lost or how much of his hands, but sounds like, yeah. He didn't come out with all of his parts intact on the hands and feet. And his survival just eludes any explanation by medical science. There's something, you know, a little bit more mysterious and hard to put your finger on going on with this story.
Also, it makes you wonder what we're all capable of if you believe it, you know? Like, so much of what we achieve is based upon our belief and not so much the circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's one of the themes in a lot of these survival stories that we tell, is the idea that these survivors often survive because they decided that they were going to, that they weren't going to give up. And they just had that mental fortitude and mindset to keep moving forward, which is probably a necessity to survival in these challenging situations. So in the kind of a sad, poignant twist to this story, Lincoln Hall actually died 6 years later in his late 50s, so at a pretty young age, of mesothelioma, of all things. So he survived this nightmare of a climb on Everest and had 6 good years with his wife and sons before he succumbed to this random chronic lung disease.
I'm so glad that he was able to make it down and hopefully finish raising his kids, because those last 6 years were probably really important for them.
Yep, absolutely. Knowing that his sons were teenagers, theoretically, 6 years later, they were young adults. A beautiful time period to be able to have with his family. That year, as I said, most deaths ever up to that point on Everest, 10 deaths. But in 2014, 16 climbers died. And then just this year, 2023, the death toll on Everest was 17 climbers. 5 of those climbers are missing but presumed dead on Everest. So those numbers keep going up as the traffic keeps going up on that mountain.
How many people climbed it this year? Do you have that stat?
I do. It looks like in 2023, an estimated 600 people summited Everest, including 350 Sherpas supporting 250 clients. So how many people attempted to summit is probably well beyond that number. Another fact about deaths on Everest, the majority of deaths are on descent. Between 80 and 90% of Everest deaths are on descent, and much smaller number of deaths associated with us. But interesting facts about deaths on Everest, the majority of them are caused by avalanche, actually. Falls are a close second. frostbite and exposure. Hypothermia is a cause of death. And actually acute mountain sickness like HAPE and HACE, which is what Lincoln Hall was suffering from, only accounts for about 10% of deaths on Everest. Those are pretty avoidable problems if you take the time to acclimatize and bring plenty of oxygen. And I mean, not completely avoidable, but proper planning can do a lot to prevent altitude illness. The seven P's, proper prior planning prevents piss poor performance.
Thanks for tuning in to the Crux True Survival Stories. Today, I had really hoped to recap our first ever episode, which remains our most listened to. Unfortunately, the recording is no longer accessible on my computer, but you can easily access it on your device anytime. Our most popular episode features Beck Weather's incredible survival story on Mount Everest. Once again, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for supporting us. You can connect with us on Instagram at The Crux Podcast or via email, which is The Crux Podcast. Have a great week and stay tuned for more gripping tales of survival.